Professor Strauss, Political Philosophy of Plato, session for April 7, 1965.
Well, let us then turn to the Protagoras. I warned you that we will be go into very great detail, and that is, but I think after having given fair warning in advance, I'm not obliged to repeat that all the time. Now let us begin at the beginning. The dialogue is called Protagoras. Let me just reflect for one moment on the title. Why is this title chosen? No, of course, only those who have ever looked at the dialogue could possibly answer this question. Well, why is the dialogue called Crito? Called Crito. Yes?
Well, it's a discussion that Socrates has with Crito.
With Crito.
Yeah, this is mainly a discussion with Protagoras.
But here you say mainly. The Crito is not a dialogue mainly with Crito.
Only.
So, well, the general rule, Plato never calls a dialogue with the name of Socrates, with one big exception. But no one could hear that, Mr. Dry. No one could hear you.
Oh, the apology.
Apology, yeah, the title is Apology of Socrates. The name of Socrates occurs only in the context of Apology of Socrates, never else. So, and if there is a single interlocutor, there is no question. It will be called after that single interlocutor. Crito, Euthyphron, and such questions. But if there are more than one, Plato had to make a choice. In the case of the Protagoras, the choice of Protagoras was a matter of course, given the substance, because it is chiefly a conversation with Protagoras. The case of the Gorgias is somewhat different, because Gorgias, the conversation with Gorgias is only a short, small part, a very small part of the conversations in that book. But here it has a special reason, because the whole dialogue is addressed, the dialogue with the other people, with Polos and Callicles, is addressed to Gorgias. So you see one has to make distinctions here. Now, in the case of the Laches, for example, where there are two equally outstanding men, Laches and Nicias, it is a great question, why is it called Laches, since Nicias is much more of an intellectual figure than Laches, a kind of general pattern. And Nicias is a very sophisticated man, and yet it is called after that non-intellectual man. That would be a question which we cannot discuss here. Now, the dialogues have, in the tradition, subtitles. There is no proof that they stem from Plato, but some of them were already used by Aristotle. So they probably, some of them at any rate, go back to the immediate the environment of Plato himself, and therefore we should treat them with some respect. Now, what is the subtitle of the Protagoras? Yes?
The Sophists.
Sophists, yes. The Gorgias is called in the subtitle On Rhetoric. The Protagoras is not called On Sophistry. That is of some interest. Sophistry is surely not the explicit theme of the Protagoras, as rhetoric is the explicit theme of the Gorgias. Now let us remind ourselves briefly of what the Gorgias says about the relation of sophistry and rhetoric. In 519c, the Sophists claim to be teachers of virtue. Now this implies in the context something of great importance. Who is supposed to be the teacher of virtue according to the ordinary view? Because the Sophists, it's an unheard of claim that there are some individuals who say we are the teachers of virtue. Who raises the claim ordinarily?
Laws.
The laws, yes, that's the best answer. But still, what is the answer of Socrates given in the Gorgias as to who is the teacher of virtue or what?
No, not quite.
Yeah, in a sense, but he has a more, how should I say, a more provisional answer.
In a way, he's a statesman.
No.
Rhetorician.
No. Yeah, that is the same. No, but in that schema, which to which I frequently refer. What is the art which makes the soul healthy? That teaches virtue.
Legislation?
The legislative art. But there is a great difference between the legislative art and the laws. Because some laws may have been made by smatterers in the legislative art or by some poor apprentices, you know. Therefore, Socrates does not simply agree with the view that the laws are the teachers of virtues, only laws properly made, the province of the legislative art. Yes, this is one point. Sophistry, of course, is meant here in the Gorgias to be a perversion of the legislative art, but we see now the reason, because the Sophists claim to be teachers of virtue. The true teacher of virtue is legislative art. Gorgias 520a to b, the sophist and orator are identical, or at least very close to each other. Callicles thinks that rhetoric is something altogether noble or resplendent, but despises sophistry. In fact, Socrates says, sophistry is nobler than rhetoric, just as the legislative art is nobler than the art of judges or of judging. I do hope you remember that simple schema which Socrates gave in the conversation with Polos. Yeah? Can you repeat it for the benefit of those who have forgotten it?
In body and soul, there's an art that builds up and an art that restores. For body, gymnastics builds up and medicine restores. For the soul, legislation builds up and justice as punishment restores.
Yeah.
And then the shams also?
Well, we need only the two. For legislative.
Shams are sophistry for legislative and rhetoric for.
Very good. Yeah. Now, you see, now this is very strange that Socrates says to Callicles that sophistry is nobler than rhetoric, because it is a perversion of the nobler thing. It seems to be absurd, because the simple rule is that the corruption of the best is the worst. So the corruption of kingship, tyranny, is worse than the corruption of aristocracy, which is oligarchy. That's very strange. At any rate, if he takes his statement seriously and disregards the difficulty he just pointed out, sophistry would deserve to a higher degree than rhetoric to be treated as such, because it is more interesting, higher. But in the Protagoras, it's not treated as such, as seems to be indicated by the subtitle, Sophists, and not On Sophistry. But we have also seen in our survey of the Gorgias there are various kinds of rhetoric. The low one, which is simply a perversion of something else, and a very noble one. And then this would lead us to the question, can there be a noble kind of sophistry? A question which does not come up at all in this dialogue, but there is another Platonic dialogue explicitly devoted to the sophist. The dialogue entitled Sophist, in which there is indeed a presentation of the noble sophistry. Seven definitions of sophistry given, and the central one presents the noble sophistry. So we will later on see this more carefully. Now the first point which must strike us at the beginning, if we look at the first pages, is that whereas the Gorgias is a performed dialogue, or as they say, a dramatic dialogue, the Protagoras is narrated by Socrates, like some other dialogues, e.g., what's the most famous dialogue, the Republic. But as you see, if you look at the beginning of the Protagoras is a narrated dialogue that is preceded by a brief performed dialogue, very brief, between the narrator Socrates and a nameless comrade, Hetairos in Greek. Now I translated by comrade in order to make clear that this is not a friend, although in in loose usage, the word can also be used for friend. And Hetairos has a certain political connotations. The clubs of the, you know, who were dissatisfied with the democracy, they were also called Hetairiae, comradeships. And it has this also this connotation. Well, comrade, of course, has in our time, as we all know, and I almost forgot, also a political connotation. Yeah? But no longer on the part of oligarchs in the ancient sense. And the dialogue which comes closest to the Protagoras from this point of view is the dialogue Euthydemus, Euthydemos, which is narrated by Socrates and preceded by a performed dialogue between Socrates and Crito. But it is there not only preceded, but also interrupted and concluded by that performed dialogue. So it's not exactly the same. And the interesting thing is that the Euthydemus also deals with sophists, but sophists of a particularly low order, clowns almost. I mentioned in passing that the Phaedo and Symposion are dialogues narrated by men other than Socrates and preceded by a performed dialogue between the narrator and someone else. So these are the closest dialogues, closest akin to the Protagoras from this very external point of view. Now let us turn to the beginning, and Mr. Rankin will do his duty for which he has been so well trained.
Where do you come from, Socrates?
Yeah. From where do you come? So where do you come to sight? It could suggest that he comes just sudden out from the earth. And you will see that in a sense that is true. And we will see later on that Socrates was in Hades. And no wonder that he will come up from there. But this we cannot prove yet. Yes, now begin. Yes?
From where do you come to sight, Socrates? And yet I need hardly ask the question, for I know that you have been chasing the prime of youth, the prime of youth of Alcibiades. I saw him the day before yesterday, and he had got a beard like a man. And he is a man, as I may tell you in your ear, but I thought that he was still very charming. What of his beard?
No, wait. Now, it does not become entirely clear what from the translation. I will say, you see that the comrade and, as you will see later, others are present. The comrade and the other silent comrades are intimates of Socrates. They know Socrates' private life and can talk to him about it. So much so that they can even blame him for some aspect of it. Politely, of course, courteously, if he does something wrong. Socrates' choice of Alcibiades is sound in itself. I mean, there are no objections on part of this upper class man to Socrates chasing the beauty of Alcibiades. But they have only one little point. Is he not a little bit too old for that? Yeah. So he says, more literally translated, when I saw him the day before yesterday, he seemed to be a beautiful man. But a man. Yeah? To speak among ourselves. Yes. Now, Socrates presents himself as a lover of Alcibiades and of philosophy in the Gorgias. Here we see him only as lover of Alcibiades. Socrates we see is a normal Athenian, only slightly abnormal. His love is slightly too old. What did you want to say?
When they say love, they don't mean deep intimate friendship like Jonathan and David, do they? They mean homosexual love?
I'm afraid so. This does not mean, however, that is a very dark question to what, corporeal it was. That is very dark to say. But that this exists in Athens less than in Sparta. It's shown, did you ever read the story of Alcibiades, which he tells at the end of the banquet? Well, he wanted literally to sleep with Socrates. I mean, in this slightly metaphorical sense, Socrates only didn't have the slightest inclination. I cannot apologize for that because I'm not responsible for that. Yes.
What did this do to the status of Socrates' control of his passions and his perceptions of what is naturally right?
That Socrates doesn't go in for that. So, in other words, there is, I mean, if we want to use this word, there is a kind, the Greek word for what is now called, with a very, in a very drastic way, sexual intercourse, is in Greek synousia, which means literally being together with someone. But being together with someone became very soon the term for a lecture. How come? In other words, there is an intimacy of the mind. And this intimacy was something which Socrates cherished in a number of cases. In some cases he did not cherish it. And that it appeared externally to people who did not know Socrates as a desire for corporeal intimacy, he couldn't help, and he did not care particularly about it because it did not run counter to what then was regarded as feasible. But he was in, if you want to see, that is one of the most striking differences, of course, between the classical Greece and the Bible. according to the Mosaic law, that is an absolute abomination. But when you read the laws which Socrates presents, or the Athenian stranger presents in Plato's laws, he is no less strict than Moses, you could say. So it is a kind of playing here with a socially accepted practice.
How can Socrates want a meeting
of
the
world,
or being together with the mind on the
body? He's in
his
50s
or
40s, and now the body
is
13. No, he must be older than 13 at that time.
His beard is beginning to appear,
it's
not about 13.
Yeah, but I think it would be a bit older, 16 or so. I have not made any study of that, of this question, but I believe it is, he is somewhat older. Hippocrates, even, who comes in, is older than 13, I would say.
I've heard a very wise man say at the age of 44 that he couldn't be the friend of his teacher, who was about 15 years older, because partly it was the age and the wisdom that his teacher had in excess of him. And we know from Aristotle that when one man has a good gravely different in quantity than another man, they can't be friends. How can Alcibiades and Socrates possibly?
Yeah, but you rush. Let us go step by step. For the time being, we are only concerned with this limited question: how can Socrates tolerate it that people make this supposition about him? Well, one can say Socrates apparently did not regard it as indispensable on every occasion to disapprove of mores, which he regarded as fundamentally questionable. And after all, in every society there are mores which are questionable from a very severe point of view, and not only in the sphere of sex, but also in other things. And that is then sheer pedantry. Socrates would do it on the proper occasion. Yes?
From the point of view of the economy, either dramatic economy or philosophical, why does he put an end if it's such a normal thing? He makes much ado over it.
I beg your pardon?
Plato makes such a point of this. It's
because
uneconomical if it's such a normal thing.
As is indicated by this double meaning of the word synousia, being together, this becomes, of course, a symbolism. And for example, in Alcibiades' speech in the The banquet, which is based on Alcibiades' play, on Aristophanes' play. Did I say Alcibiades? I beg your pardon. Aristophanes' speech in the banquet, which is based on Aristophanes' plays. A love of young men was regarded as more political, more political, related to the polis and to the higher things than love of women. That had to do with the fundamental question, the estimation of the two sexes. Generally speaking, the male sex was, I apologize to the ladies, regarded in former times as inferior to the male sex. Yeah? And therefore, for example, that the very question, very term, paternal power instead of parental power. This is pointed out so much by Locke, this point. The Bible says honor father and mother, and not merely honor father, the father. But still people spoke ordinarily of paternal power was based on the excellency of the male sex, which in individual cases, of course, could happen that the mother is a much superior person than the father, but this was somehow an unnatural situation, that a woman should really be able to control the household in the manner. Now this leads to all kinds of depth, deeper questions, and therefore Plato's suggestion in the Republic that the two sexes should be equal is a very great paradox and treated as such in the Republic. Now, that women should be kings or rulers as well as men. And now, if we look at the history of mankind up to the present day, taking into consideration facts which Plato did not know, Plato has been born out to some extent. There have been some famous rulers, female rulers, Catherine the Great, Elizabeth the First, and some others, and in business, which is related to politics somehow, also very great businesswomen and so on. But the question, so in other words, the notion of female rulers is not absurd, as Plato said. But what about the other side, female philosophers? Now, if you look at the history of philosophy, I think you do not, and look at the galaxy of the men who surely belong to the top shelf, they are all men. Poets is a different story, but in philosophy that is so. When I explained this once to a professor of philosophy at another university, he said, but what about Susan Stebbing? And I only said, I'm sorry, I forgot her. Susan Stebbing was a British logician, I think quite a respectable woman, but of course she herself would not have claimed that she would belong to the top thing. So you have to take this broader question in consideration. So the male sex is one more related to the common concern. Politics in the first place and wisdom of the documents above all, and this is somehow mirrored on a comical level in everyday life in this thing. Does it make sense? So to come back here to the point, Socrates presents himself here not as the sole true statesman or the other things we have seen in the Gorgias, or as he has presented himself in the Apology, as a man with the mission, but as a practically normal Athenian, only, as I said, slightly abnormal, because Alcibiades is slightly too old. Now, how does Socrates get out of that fix?
What of his beard? Are you not of Homer's opinion, who says, youth is most charming when the beard first appears? And that is now the charm of Alcibiades.
Yeah. So now Socrates proves his complete normality or correctitude by the authority of Homer. Homer has said that this particular age, when the beard begins to sprout, that is the most charming age. Now, the word is applied in Homer, the saying is applied in Homer, to Hermes, the god Hermes. Alcibiades has a peculiar charm of Hermes, the god of the thieves, among other things. I saw that Alcibiades was used as a model for statues of Hermes. And he was thought to be involved in the mutilations of the Hermes statues in 415. Now this 415 is much later than the dramatic date of this dialogue. Of course, Plato wrote this much later. But it must make dramatic sense. And the dramatic explanation would be that Socrates, with his sense of divination, this demonion, could very well have anticipated that this model for Hermes was dissatisfied with statues and not devoted to him, but to Hermes. But this is only a joke. Now, one of the two, the verse to which he alludes occurs twice in Homer, once in the Iliad and once in the Odyssey in Book 10. And in the quotation in Book 10, this passage occurs shortly before the sole mention of nature, which ever occurs in Homer. In this passage, Hermes teaches Odysseus the nature of a herb. I raise this question. Could Hermes, like Alcibiades, be by any chance the teacher of Socrates? This would, of course, presuppose that just as Alcibiades is Hermes-like, Socrates is Odysseus-like. That is an open question. I would not raise this question if I had not some reason that it will be suspicion that as later it will be suggested that Socrates is in a way, in this dialogue, an Odysseus. So, at any rate, Socrates has refuted the charge that he did something abnormal by the authority of Homer. Now, what does the comrade say?
Well, and how do matters stand now? Have you been visiting him, and what are his feelings toward you?
Yeah, he says, and how is the youth disposed toward you? Now, you see, the comrade is beaten. He calls Alcibiades now a youth, and no longer a man. Otherwise, he returns to his initial question. Where do you come from him? But he is no longer as certain as he was at the beginning that Socrates comes from Alcibiades as a matter of course. It's now a real question. Accordingly, he adds now a second question. How is Alcibiades disposed toward you? Because if it is not so certain, maybe you had some lovers' quarrel in the meantime. Good. Now, how does Socrates reply?
Good, I thought, and especially today, for I have just come from him, and he has been helping me in an argument. But shall I tell you a strange thing? I paid no attention to him, and several times I quite forgot that he was present.
Yes. Now, Socrates answers first the second question, and namely, how Alcibiades is disposed toward him, and then the first, whether he comes from. Alcibiades' disposition toward Socrates is unchanged, so why should he not come from? But strangely, Socrates' disposition toward Alcibiades has changed, at least for the time being. Socrates barely noticed him. And this is, of course, a very remarkable big event, which, if there had been someone like Walter Winchell in Athens, would have been duly an era of France. Now, let's go on.
What is the meaning of this? Has anything happened between you and him? For surely you cannot have discovered a fairer love than he is. Certainly not in this city of Athens.
Yeah, it is certainly not in this city. So the accident is perfectly proper way. What an extraordinary event. The biggest news in town. The only possible explanation, of course, is that Sugaris has met some youth still more beautiful than Alcibiades. But there is no more beautiful youth in Athens than Alcibiades. Perhaps not even in the world. No?
Yes, much fairer. What do you mean? A citizen or a foreigner? A foreigner.
So Sugaris did meet someone more beautiful than Alcibiades, but indeed not an Athenian. And this, therefore, the reputation of Alcibiades as the most beautiful young man in Athens is unimpaired. Yes?
Of what country? Of Abdera. And is this stranger really, in your opinion, a fairer love than the son of Clinias?
The son of Clinias is Alcibiades. Now, you see that the comrade is incredulous, yeah? As you see from his last speech. And so beautiful did that stranger seem to be to you, yeah? So that he came to sight, which also can have the meaning of seeming as more beautiful than the son of Clinias. So in other words, he regards it as possible that Sugaris was under an optic illusion by believing he had seen someone more beautiful. Yes?
And is not the wiser always the fairer, sweet friend?
How should the wisest neuter appear to be more beautiful? Yes, sweet friend, I'll speak of that word later. It is then not strange that Sugaris paid no attention to Alcibiades, because the most wise is bound to appear more beautiful than Alcibiades. The neuter is important. He doesn't say the wisest man. The neuter, because the wise is not necessarily a human being. It may be a logos, a speech. Yeah? And this might appear to be wiser. The adjective which he uses here in addressing him, Makaria. First of all, it underlines the fact that the comrade remains nameless. Sugaris knew, of course, his name, but the mere fact that his name is never used underlines the fact that he remains nameless. I would, it means literally translated, "You blessed one." "You blessed one," but he's of course now has sunk down and does not have the full meaning. But if we write, I suggest that we understand it, "How blessed you are, by virtue of the fact that you are wise." That is obviously ironical. Now the next speech.
"But have you really met Socrates with some wise one? Say rather, with the wisest of all..."
No, wait. Here the position is very remarkable here. "But did you meet some..." how shall we translate it? The stranger admits without difficulty that is important, that the wisest thing is more beautiful than mere beauty, and in particular than the mere beauty of Alcibiades. Here I would say what he implies is here is because he uses wise in the singular, in the positive, not in the superlative, we, you, and you, Sugaris, and I are of course not wise. That's implied. You have met a wise man. There's a rarity. They do not belong to this group of people. Yes?
"Say rather, with the wisest of all living men, if you were willing to accord that title to Protagoras."
Yes?
"What, is Protagoras in Athens?" "Yes, he has been here 2 days." "And do you just come from an interview with him?" "Yes."
Now let us stop here. Now, the comrade does not know that Protagoras is in town, obviously. And Socrates does not only know it, but has already met him. It is safe to conclude that Socrates is much more of a, quote, intellectual than the comrade. He knows of the movements of these famous men, and much earlier than they do. Yes?
Yes, and I have said and heard many things.
You say he says that first, before having heard. He emphasizes the fact that he has spoken in the being together with Protagoras. He thus emphasizes the difference between himself and the comrades who only listen, as will become quite clear from the sequel. Yes?
Then, if you have no engagement, please do sit down right here and tell me about your conversation.
Yeah, the word used is synousia, or your being together, which, as you see, has here the meaning of, indeed, of conversation, but it has this ambiguity which I pointed out. Yes?
And my attendant here shall give up his place to you.
Yeah, meaning, of course, is slave. Yeah. Why do you not tell to us? Which means there are a number of people present. Just as there are a number of people present in the conversation with Protagoras, as we shall see soon. And from this we learn already one point, that in the conversation immediately following with Hippocrates, which is in the center of the dialogue, because we have first his initial conversation with the comrade, then the conversation with Hippocrates, and then the conversation which is, makes up the bulk of the work with Protagoras. The central one is that with Hippocrates, and this is a dialogue where Socrates is alone with one man, whereas he is together with many in the first and the third. It is clear that the comrade and the others will only hear the story. They will not speak. He is eager to hear, obviously, of course, since he is a polite man, unless Socrates is detained. Then he naturally would forego the pleasure of hearing that. Socrates?
To be sure, and I shall be grateful to you for listening.
Yeah. Socrates is eager to tell. They are eager to hear. And he is, of course, not detained. Now, in order to understand that, let us read the very end of the dialogue.
By all means, I said.
Now, yeah, perhaps we begin a bit earlier where
Protagoras replied.
Yeah. Yeah.
Socrates, I am not of a base nature, and I am the last man in the world to be envious. I cannot but applaud your energy and your conduct of an argument. As I have often said, I admire you above all the men I meet, and far above all men of your age. And I dare say that I would not be surprised if you were to become one of those who are distinguished for their wisdom. Let us come back to the subject at some future time of your choice. At present, we had better turn to something else.
Yes?
By all means, I said, if that is your wish. For I, too, ought long since to have kept the engagement of which I spoke before, and only tarried because I could not refuse the request of the noble Callias. So the conversation ended, and we went our way.
So, what about this engagement of Socrates? That was a wide line. Socrates had plenty of time, but immediately after having left the conversation with Protagoras, he tells this story of the conversation with Protagoras. Socrates is not busy in any way. His leisure is infinite. Of course, it also shows, incidentally, such a thing, the tremendous memory of Socrates. that he can tell the whole conversation with all its incidents and details as it happened. Memory is regarded very highly by Plato, as you know from the Republic and other places. Mr. Levy?
Why did you mention a few minutes ago that why did you point out that this conversation with Hippocrates is the only conversation with alone if you're talking to somebody else? It's a central conversation. Why is that important that it's a central conversation? Previously we mentioned something about the center of Hippocrates.
Yeah. I know. This is a good question, and I shall be glad to answer it, because it gives me an opportunity for displaying my ignorance. The importance of the center I know only empirically, in the good old sense of the word empirically, meaning I know the fact without knowing the reason, yeah, that it means empirically. I just stumbled on it and was amazed by it. And I don't know why. Now, I learned this for the first time. I observed it in some passage in the first book of Plato's Laws, when he enumerated three things which seem to be presented in order of descent, 1, 2, 3. And number 2 proved to be most important. And I took, of course, for granted that number 1 is most important because it's high in rank. And then I said, it seems that what is in the center is most important, which doesn't mean most important absolutely, because it was clearly not most important absolutely in this case, but in the context. And this has been confirmed in my studies of Plato, of Xenophon, and of Thucydides, and quite a few other ancient and even later writers. There is never any reason given, but I came across some indirect reason. For instance, in some writings, late writings, on forensic rhetoric. And there they use this rule, they suggest this rule, that if you defend a fellow against an accusation, you bring in his weak spots in the center, because at the beginning all people are attentive, and at the end, as you, everyone has ever given a lecture knows, when people are sound asleep and you say, "Now I come to my conclusion," they awake. And therefore, so you know, where they listen, you speak of his strong sides, and where they are asleep, you speak of his weak sides and try to make the best of them. And there is another thing. In Xenophon's remarks about tactics, military tactics in the strict sense, build up a fighting unit. The good, brave men come in the front line and in the rear, and the cowards in the middle. Same principle, you know, because they can't be trusted unless they run away. Now you can, in other words, this means in the first place, the weakest things come in the middle. That is common to both, yeah, to tactics and forensic rhetoric. But which are the weakest things in a broader sense of the term? Those which are least easily publicly defensible. They may be much higher in rank. This is roughly. And then, of course, after this has become an established thing, then it is, so to speak, lives on its own power, and you make it a rule to do that. The difficulty, well, there are minor difficulties. For example, if the things enumerated consist of an even number, then it is obvious you have to take the 2 central ones as important. If they are 10, there must be number 5 and 6, and so on. That's clear. This is the thing which I can only say I found very helpful in many cases. I would not start building an argument about it. I find something very strange in the middle, I would keep it in mind and see whether something will not turn up which gives me some light. It is a heuristic principle, not something which you can mechanically use. Yes?
I putting the earth in the center of the universe was that this position, that is the center position, must be such an important position, I think he says, cannot be reserved for anything else but the most important body.
Yeah, but this is, and also generally speaking, the link between two things. Yeah? Well, if you take the link between two extremes, is of course also in the middle. I know that, but these are then the most important things. The most important, absolutely, I mean.
But the earth, I don't see why it says the earth must be in the center, the most important, and therefore whoever made our nation must.
Yeah, that's true.
Not linking anything.
Yeah, well, I have not considered that, and I do not. I cannot. I have not ever been induced by anything what I saw to think of that. But maybe it is important. But whereas these things from forensic rhetoric and tactics I observe, and they have been confirmed since by other things. So let us read the end now again of this dialogue with the Hippocrates. And I will thank you, yeah, if you listen. Yes?
I should be grateful to you for listening. Thank you, too, for telling us.
Yeah.
That is thank you twice over.
Yeah,
listen.
So the thanks, the grace in Greek charis, yeah, will be twofold. Yes? Yes?
Listen. Last.
No. And now listen. So, it's now comes the story. So. Good. We have seen by looking at the end of the conversation, of the dialogue, that the conversation with Protagoras is unfinished. We will see it later more clearly. And this is unfinished not through Socrates' fault, because Protagoras is exhausted or tired. Now, from this brief conversation with a comrade, we see that Socrates' narrative is voluntary to the highest degree. He is eager to tell. We will see that his conversation with Protagoras is compulsory to the extent that he is compelled by Hippocrates, this young man, to go with him to Protagoras. And this is quite interesting, that a dialogue may be compulsory, and yet the report about it may be voluntary. I believe you all have observations of this kind made from time to time, that you were compelled to have a certain conversation, which you didn't enjoy at all, but later on it was exhilarating to tell him. That can happen. You see also that the comrade asks him to take, asks Socrates to take the place of the attendant, of slave, of course, of an inferior, socially, intellectually inferior. That is suggested. Now, this, to summarize the point, this proemium, as we call it, tells us to whom, i.e. to what kind of people, the Protagoras is narrated. There is a difference between the men addressed by within the dialogue and the men addressed by the dialogue. Is not clear? Now, the men addressed by the dialogue are, in a sense, of course, we too. That men addressed by a published, written dialogue are the readers. Also, the addressees of Socrates and the addressees of Plato are not necessarily identical. I mean, if you take the Crito, the addressee of the Crito, in the Crito, is Socrates, is Crito, of course. But in also the Crito is addressed to us. And if the narrator and the narrator of the dialogue and the chief interlocutor in the dialogue, Socrates, I mean, are identical, then it is blurred, the difference is blurred, but nevertheless still visible. Now, what kind of man is in the dialogue told? We have made some observations about that comrade. he's obviously a friendly to Socrates. How deep that friendliness goes, we are unable to figure out because we haven't seen him in a tough situation. He's an admirer of Alcibiades' beauty, not entirely uncritical in regard to Socrates. For example, if Socrates loves Alcibiades and Alcibiades is a bit too old, he says so. He is eager to listen to speeches, but otherwise rather nondescript. This is, in a way, the typical reader of the Gorgias. At any rate, the beginning of the Protagoras shows us, in contradistinction to the beginning of the Gorgias, shows us Socrates in deep peace with the world. As you have seen, no difficulty. The Gorgias begins with the words war, fight and battle. Nothing of this kind here. In deep peace with the world, in other words, sound asleep. And that is the transition to what we are going to read now. The conversation with Hippocrates, which begins now and goes to 314c, leads to this result that Hippocrates accompanies Socrates to Protagoras. Just as Chaerephon accompanied Socrates to Gorgias, more precisely, whereas Socrates goes to Gorgias spontaneously, he's eager to talk to him, he goes to Hippocrates, to Protagoras, for the sake of Hippocrates, compelled by Hippocrates. One can tentatively say, the Protagoras is devoted to the higher theme, sophistry. But there Socrates goes with the lower companion. Chaerephon is a mature man, an old friend of Socrates. And the Gorgias has a lower theme, but the companion is higher. Whether this means anything, whether it even is completely true, we must see from the sequel. Now, let us read the beginning.
Last night, or rather very early this morning...
Yeah, let us stop here for one moment. Now, very early in the morning something happened. And we are told everything what happened from this moment on. Until now when he tells his story to the friends. So, the result is very simple. What has Socrates done from the early morning until now?
He's been up and talking.
Talking. Nothing else. Good. And this, incidentally, to come back to the symbolism of the sexes, which is the sex sometimes accused of being nothing but talking? That you know it, apparently. Now, from this point of view, the philosopher is, of course, much closer to the female sex than to the male sex. Yeah? They sit at home and talk like women. Men go out in the marketplace, in war, and other manly pursuits. Good. Now begin again, Mr. Rankin.
Last night, or rather very early this morning, could that be a reference to the two dreams? Truth, gate of horn, gate of ivory?
I do not know. Let us first begin at the beginning so that we have a complete impression of this.
Last night, or rather very early this morning, Hippocrates, the son of Apollodorus and the brother of Phaeson, gave a tremendous thump with his staff at my door. Someone opened to him, and he came rushing in and bawled out, "Socrates, are you awake or asleep?"
Now let us stop. Now you see, Hippocrates is obviously eager, lively, vehement. Socrates is awakened by the noise made by Hippocrates. But he did not hear who opened the door. It is clearly easy to enter Socrates' home, as you see. It's much more difficult to enter the place where Protagoras is, as we shall see later. There is a reference to the father and the brother of Hippocrates, which means it is hard to identify him. Maybe there was another Hippocrates, son of Apollodorus, and he had to be distinguished from him by the addition of the brother. So he is not, I would say, not a man as well known, a young man as well known as Alcibiades, for example. This much seems to be clear. Let us read the immediate sequel.
I recognized his voice and said...
He recognized his voice. Why is this important? Obviously. Because it's stark. It all in the lines is stark. Yes?
Hippocrates, is that you? No bad news, I hope. Good news, he said. Nothing but good. Delightful, I said. But what is the news? And why have you come here at this unearthly hour? He drew nearer to me and said, Protagoras has arrived. Yes, I replied, he came 2 days ago. Have you only just heard of his arrival? Yes, by the gods, he said, but not until yesterday evening.
Now let us stop here. So it's strongly emphasized throughout as you see that it is dark. So early did he come. And so his reaction is, when he hears his voice, some earthquake, no, Protagoras has come to Athens. Hippocrates had heard earlier of it than the comrade, this you see. You know? The comrade has heard it only from Socrates. And so we conclude that Hippocrates is on a higher level of, quote, intellectualism than the comrade. You know? Socrates is very sober, as he always is. The fact that you have good news is no reason why you should disturb my... Implying, in the case of bad news, if you would need my help, it would, of course, be reason. Hippocrates, as you see, has a habit of command. You know, it was quite a feat for him not to come already last night. Immediately after he heard it. He explains in the sequel why he did not come in the evening, as we shall see. This is a great amazing thing that he came only at 4 o'clock in the morning and not at 12 o'clock in the night. Now, yes, go on. No. What will happen to him is this. He will be compelled. Men must think of self-preservation, that comes up. And therefore, he will be compelled to enter society. And there is Mr. Muller, i.e. a source of unhappiness. So the only happiness of which man is actually capable is that of not remaining below the level of the city, below the level of Cato, to take the grace in hand, but to transcend it. And that is a preserve of a very small number of people. Rousseau would, of course, include himself. That's it. It is what Rousseau does is, in other words, a kind of, in a modified form, in a radically modified form, the Aristotelian notion, and Nicomachean Ethics end. The political or practical life, actuality of moral political virtue is happiness, requires equipment. And then there is something transcending the theoretical life, which requires equipment to a much lesser degree. Because Aristotle thinks, of course, of a man who is politically active in the highest possible form, as statesman and so, then you must be, in the schema which Aristotle assumes, well born, of reasonable wealth, and must have family, all worries, you know. But the theoretical man, as theoretical man, is beyond these worries. He needs equipment to a much lesser degree, and this is a higher form. This is, you can say, what is behind Rousseau. But Rousseau cannot maintain the supremacy of the theoretical life as Aristotle understood it. That has to do with Mikado de Fanzarises. And therefore he gets this upside down theoretical life, which is the sentiment of existence.
But would Rousseau say that for people who do not have the unhappiness of people who do not have the capacity to go up to this top level is increased by being pushed above a certain level as if they were going to get there when they can't?
Yeah, no, no. What happens here? This is not. It cannot yet be developed. Is this? There are, of course, enormous compensations in being a citizen. Yeah, I mean, speaking purely from a point of view of happiness or even of pleasure, the pleasure of self-love, of amor proper, especially of pride, patriotic pride, for example, will compensate for many hardships, not only of civilian peacetime life, but even of soldiers' wartime life and dying for the country, this kind of thing. You know? As Rousseau says somewhere, he cannot say everything simultaneously. And this has one advantage, we can really follow the steps of the argument better. Yeah. Good. Huh?
This late statement sounds like last one.
Well, there is a connection between last word. But whoever said that last word says nonsense always? No one's ever said that. Good. Turn to the bottom of page 46. Then he describes the miserable life we lead since we are not wise.
Thus we grasp everything, we cling to everything. We are anxious about time, place, people, things, all that is and will be. We ourselves are but the least part of ourselves.
Yeah, so let us stop here. Every man who is not wise is only a fraction of a man, because a large part of him are things, places, human beings who are not him. This reminds of the description of the citizen as a fractionary unit. You know, this is, in other words, this fractional, man being fractionary, is a more broader phenomenon than that of the citizen, a citizen only. This I wanted to say. Yeah, there are, let me see. Somewhat later, I do not have the reference here, it must be on page 47, 48, the paragraph beginning, society has made man more feeble, not only in taking from him the... Yes?
Not merely by robbing him of the right to his own strength, but still more by making his strength insufficient for his needs.
Yeah, let us stop, and let us then go on. One, two, three, third paragraph from this.
When our natural tendencies have not been interfered with by human prejudice and human institutions, the happiness alike of children and of men consists in the enjoyment of their liberty. But the child's liberty is restricted by his lack of strength.
By his weakness.
His weakness. He who does as he likes is happy, provided he is self-sufficing.
I.e. provided that is his desires do not extend beyond his forces. Yeah? Yes.
It is so with the man
who wrote after the first book on an earlier occasion.